This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, and I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. I am super excited about today's podcast, which is a very special episode, though not in the way old TV sitcoms used to do very special episodes, you know, like when a character you never heard of but suddenly is central to the storyline, or the cast would die, or we'd learn about some terrible new disease that we needed to combat with a national effort, or Nancy Reagan would show up and guest star for God knows what reason. No. Today's very special episode of The Reason Interview involves talking with Jonah Goldberg, the former longtime National Review editor and author of Liberal Fascism and Suicide of the West. Jonah is a very prominent conservative critic of Donald Trump, and just a few months ago, he announced his departure from National Review, where he worked for two decades. He now hangs his hat at a new media venture called The Dispatch, which involves another very prominent conservative, the former editor-in-chief of The Weekly Standard, Stephen Hayes, and yet another former National Review scribe, David French, who I interviewed a couple months ago. You can check that out online. I talk with Goldberg in this podcast about the reasons he left the flagship publication of the American right wing. What's going on there? What he thinks about the always shaky relations between libertarians and conservatives, and what he, Hayes, and French hope to achieve with The Dispatch. Jonah and I have been publicly feuding for the entire 21st century, but what makes this episode of The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie super special is that it's simply part one of a two-part, two-hour-long conversation. The second half takes place on Goldberg's own podcast, The Remnant, and it drops tomorrow, which is Thursday, December 4th. You can subscribe to The Remnant at jonahgoldberg.com, Apple, Google, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Go do that now. Listen to this interview. Subscribe to The Remnant, and then you're going to get 2 hours of Jonah Goldberg and me jawing about everything under the sun, but especially about conservative and libertarian politics in the age of Trump. Now, before we get to our very special episode of The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, I want to ask you to subscribe to this podcast, of course, as well as The Reason Roundtable, a rollicking weekly conversation featuring me, Matt Welch, Peter Suderman, and Reason Editor-in-Chief Catherine Mangu Ward, and the Soho Forum Debates, which presents the monthly debates Reason sponsors in New York City. You can check out our archives of past episodes and subscribe to all three at reason.com/podcasts or at Apple, Google, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Please take a moment and subscribe to all three today. And wait, there's more. I hate to be stretching out this intro like a carnival sideshow barker, but I also want to tell you that we're in the middle of Reason's annual webathon when we ask our readers, viewers, and listeners to support our journalism via fully tax-deductible donations. As you may know, Reason is published by a nonprofit foundation, and we cover our costs partly through the support of people like you who believe in free minds and free markets, in producing great journalism, and bringing a libertarian perspective to all debates about politics, culture, and ideas. Reason started in 1968 as a mimeographed monthly magazine, and it's now a fully fledged alternative media operation that reaches millions of people a month via print, the web, and our videos and podcasts since 2016, which is when we started doing podcasts. We're your voice in the public arena, but we're also a source of cutting-edge news and opinion from a libertarian point of view. We've got great swag associated with different giving levels, too. So please go to reason.com and donate what you can so we can keep on keeping on. And now, onto a very special episode of The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, featuring special guest star Jonah Goldberg. Jonah Goldberg, thanks for sitting down in this uncomfortably close and getting very warm sound booth.
It is It's intimate. It's an intimate booth. I'll grant you that. Yeah.
This is, yeah. I mean, it's like Sinatra and Sammy Davis or something. It's a little bit familiar, to be quite honest.
I'll give you 10 minutes to get your hand off my crotch.
Okay. All right. Well, those are going to be 10 long minutes for one of us.
For one of us. Yeah.
So, Jonah Goldberg, you made your career at National Review earlier this year. What was it, a couple months ago? When did The Dispatch, and we're going to talk about that, your new platform, when did that officially launch?
So the official launch, where there will be actual website with web-only material and all that, is January 7, but we did what we were calling sort of a soft launch, mm-hmm. or a, what do they call it, like opening in Peoria kind of thing.
Okay. So you're doing
October.
A tryout.
Yeah. So part of the whole idea of this new platform, okay. right?
And it's called The Dispatch.
It's called The Dispatch.
How can people get on your mailing list?
Yeah, you can go to thedispatch.com and you can sign up there for all that. And right now, we are basically, the only products we're pushing out are newsletters. And newsletters are going to be a big part of what we're doing. We think that the near future of the internet is moving more and more towards pushed content, meaning stuff that comes to you. Very few people, if you look at the analytics, I'd be curious if it's all that different in the with Reason's numbers, but the number of people who actually just type in Reason.com or NationalReview.com is just shrinking every day.
Right.
And people get stuff virally, they get stuff forwarded to them, and it's a part of what we're doing is we're leaning heavily into that. And so our major products are going to be podcasts and newsletters, but we're also going to have a website that will, at least in the beginning, and we hope forever, be more or less ad-free.
Wow.
And
so then I'm getting this stuff for free. Am I going to have to pay for it, though, at some point?
At some point, you're going to have to pay.
It's a good thing I can use fiat currency, which is essentially worthless. I understand, and I'm sure you get some of this, but on the libertarian side, that, you know, the Federal Reserve, since it was created in the 19-teens, has so devalued the money in America that, like, it's worthless. So I can, you can charge me whatever you want, and I can pay it.
Yeah, I didn't know we were going to descend into gold buggery this quickly.
No, I don't. I wish I were a gold bug. I'm like Joey Ramone. I want something to believe in, but I'm not going there. But the
if you honestly think that fiat currency that we have now is truly worthless, give me all of yours.
I would love to, but I don't carry a lot of cash.
I understand.
So.
Okay. So.
No, I don't. I've never understood that argument, because all I know is that when I go to McDonald's, the nominal prices don't change. The portions get bigger. And so like if that's a devalued currency, I think it's a pretty good thing.
Yeah. Also, the thing not to express our, you know, air our grievances about these kinds of things, but the thing that drives me crazy is whenever I make the mistake of engaging in a deep conversation about, you know, the worthlessness of paper money or fiat currency or whatever it is, they always say, well, you know, gold is a more real storehouse of value.
Mm.
And I was like, no, it's a social construct too.
Obviously,
The things of real value are the things you need on day two of the zombie apocalypse.
Right.
And the guy who's carrying out huge chunks of gold is going to have his brains eaten pretty quickly.
I don't think William Devane or G. Gordon Liddy are going to make it very far, right? With their huge sacks of Roslyn gold or Roslyn capital. But wait, before we get dragged down into monetary theory and whatnot, The Dispatch is a publication or a platform, a new offering that it's you and Steve Hayes, late of the Weekly Standard.
Yes.
And also David French.
Yes.
Late of Fire way back in the day, but then also the U.S. military and more recently National Review.
Right.
Explain the genesis. So, and this is kind of like a super group. This is like Al Cooper, Mike Bloomberg, and Stephen Stills or something getting together. You have three giants of maybe it's Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Yeah.
I don't know, or it's the three tenors, I will not be able to remember what the Dolly Parton, Emmylou Harris, and Linda Ronstadt bit was called, but it's something like that.
Yeah, traveling Wilburys too.
Okay, all right. You've only got three so far.
Right.
But what happened? The Weekly Standard got shut down.
Yeah,
because the current owner, Philip Anschutz, was just like, okay, I don't need that anymore. I don't want that anymore. He also publishes the Washington Examiner.
Right.
He's very pro-Trump. He's very conservative. At National Review, you know, so that he shut down the Weekly Standard.
Yeah. So
right?
I don't know how pro-Trump he is.
Okay.
I think the people who work for him, who run his media stuff, are pro-Trump. Whether they are pro-Trump by out of sincerity or out of a theory of what the market demands from them remains unclear to me as well.
Wow.
It's always funny, like when I do stuff with Steve is under a binding NDA type thing, and he cannot speak ill of anybody or any of his experiences.
So do you, you
but I am not, so bound.
Okay, no, because then I was going to say, so you torment him by saying outrageous things, and then you see how long he can take. It's like eating hot peppers.
It's fun. Every now and then I'll just say, well, you know, the reason the standard shut down is just because it was, you know, it was anti-Trump and all this kind of stuff. And a lot of that stuff is just not true.
Right.
Okay, so, and I will, just to avoid complications in my complicated life, steer clear of disclosures that would get Stephen in any trouble. Mm-hmm. But the gist of it is that they closed down the Weekly Standard because they wanted to harvest its organs. And for understandable reasons.
And by its organs, you mean its subscription list?
Basically, its subscription list.
And some of the people, right? Because some of the people went from the Standard to the Examiner.
Some of them did. A bunch didn't.
Right.
And my understanding of it from various sources is that Phil Anschutz, who I've met and I personally think is kind of a decent guy, but his real love is the Examiner. He sunk untold millions into that. Remember, he bought all his newspapers.
Yeah, it was going to be a vast empire starting from the San Francisco Bay to like Long Island Sound, right? Yeah,
right.
I mean, he bought the San Francisco Examiner, the Washington Examiner, a bunch of other papers. That didn't really pan out.
It didn't, but he has, as your libertarian friends will use the phrase, sunk costs.
Right.
And so by law, if you shut down a magazine, you have to refund the subscribers for the unused portion of the subscription.
Or replace it with another
publication. Yeah. So they did that. So they jump-started the magazine that the Examiner is putting out. But the notions out there, which you hear from a lot of detractors of Steve or Bill Kristol and all the rest, is that the Standard was losing money. To some extent, that's probably true.
Yeah.
It was losing less money, is my understanding, than the Examiner was,
right?
The idea that it was purely because it was too anti-Trump, well, there are a lot of pretty serious, dedicated, and reasonable people in the Examiner world who are very critical of Trump.
Right.
It had more to do with a business strategy than anything else. I think at the end of the day, it wasn't done as honorably as it should have been done because it became pretty clear that they weren't interested in selling the Standard, because there were other buyers who were interested.
Right.
And
right.
So what we're trying to...
And, you know, it's Anschutz's property, right?
He's free to do what he wants.
Been created, or it was originally funded by Rupert Murdoch back in the day. It got sold, you know, et cetera. What I loved about the Weekly Standard when it came online, I think in 1995, if I'm not mistaken.
Thereabouts, yeah.
I likened it to the Marlins baseball team, because within its like first 5 years, it had started two wars. First in Yugoslavia, the future Yugoslavia, as I like to call it, and also in Afghanistan. So they had an incredible run, really, for a relatively short-lived magazine.
Yeah.
But they did pretty well.
And people forget when that Chinese plane forced one of our planes down.
Oh, yeah.
Bill was pretty eager to start some trouble with air, too.
He seemed to be more interested in China. I mean, like 9/11 actually pulled him out of really going hammer and tong after China to, you know, a different part of the world.
People also forget that Bill and David Brooks ran a whole bunch of stuff about national greatness.
Oh, yeah. That was where it started from. Yeah. And also, then every third issue, I think, contractually, was David Frum talking about the libertarian temptation.
Mm-hmm. There was
So the Weekly Standard folded. Steve Hayes, who's an immensely talented journalist, I disagree with him on certain things, agree on others. At one point, way back in the day, actually offered him a job at Reason, and he held out for the Weekly Standard, obviously a much better fit. But great magazine, or interesting magazine, had for a long time one of the best back of the books, I think, et cetera. But it's gone. We miss it. It's your opportunity now at the Dispatch. Why did you leave National Review?
Yeah. So, I mean, I often joke with Steve is that, you know, his ships were burnt from under him. Uh-huh. I had to set fire to mine. You know?
All right.
So I talked to Steve throughout a lot of this process. And one of the things I would tell him was, look, I understand that you feel morally, and you are morally obliged to try and save the Standard. You know, you inherited this job, and you should do everything you can for your staff and for the institution to keep it going. But to be honest, there's an argument to be made that starting something new without I'm not saying it's all negative by any stretch, but the brand baggage, you know, there's something there to start something new. And then when that was always sort of plan B, and eventually it became plan A. And so my reasons for leaving NR, they are not, again, what a lot of detractors wanted to make it out to be, which were that I was forced out. I wasn't. That I left on some grand, you know, principle. I didn't. I did feel like I was in a rut.
Mm-hmm.
I did not like the feeling of being something of a hindrance to the magazine because of the way I would write about Trump and various things. But in no way was like I being shown the door in any, by any stretch of the imagination.
So this isn't like a Game of Thrones scenario.
No, it is not. Okay. So one of the reasons why I want to do it is I just wanted to start something new.
Wait, before we go, when you say the way that you wrote about Trump was a hindrance, explain that a little bit. Because, I mean, National Review famously in, I guess it was December of 2015, that sounds about right, correct me if I'm wrong, you guys—
On the eve of the Iowa caucuses.
You ran a, you know, against Trump issue, a special issue, and it was, I thought, a bold, you know, and I, as a former editor of, you know, magazines and creator of platforms, I think about this stuff in a lot of different ways. And I thought beyond the content, the gesture was fantastic because there was a lot of anger and disappointment and disgust or revulsion with Trump from Republicans and conservatives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's right to say National Review is a conservative magazine first, has been allied with the Republican Party virtually all of its existence.
Sure.
But it's a secondary thing, but it was a bold statement and it went through, you know, like a comprehensive case against Trump. Were you too friendly towards Trump? Was that friction?
I mean, so in 2015, like most conservatives, including a lot of people who are on places like Fox News talking about how wonderful Trump is, the general consensus among a broad swath of conservatives of all sorts of occupations and ideological orientations was that Trump was a joke. And so I was one of the guys who lobbied pretty hard for the against Trump issue. It has now been retconned into a never Trump issue, which it wasn't. The term didn't exist back then.
Right.
And
it was against Trump.
It was. It was against Trump.
I mean,
right?
Literally against. I think
the cover was against Trump. Yeah.
Right.
And the position we took, which was, I mean, it was one of my real epiphanies about the power of populism to sort of make people crazy. I remember when it came out, I've told the story on my podcast before, but when it came out, all sorts of people, journalist people, opinion people, friends of the magazine, writers, also across Fox News, it was amazing. Who was National Review to tell people who to vote for? Was this like rallying cry? And they were outraged at the hubris or the elitism of National Review to tell people who to vote for. And I was like, that's what we do.
Right.
It's literally what we've done. It's one of the reasons why we never went nonprofit at National Review is because we thought it was really important to be able to endorse or not endorse or whatever. And essentially, the against Trump issue was an endorsement of the field against Trump.
Right.
And it made a lot of people very, very, very angry. I think Rich has said publicly, Rich Lowry, the editor of National Review, has said that he regrets the issue. I don't. I think it was
Why does he regret it?
I think because it's been turned into this never Trump thing, which it wasn't. A lot of the people who wrote for it became Trump supporters when they had no other options other than Hillary, right?
Right.
Binary choice and all that.
You know, I'm glad to be post-binary in almost all aspects of my life, but especially politics. I don't even think I was ever binary. I'm not even unified, but I digress.
Yeah, so, but as time went on, I don't think it's any shock to you or any listeners, large, large swaths of the Republican electorate, large swaths of National Review's readership, in terms of not just the readers, but also the sort of donors, friends of the magazine, they reconciled themselves to Trump and they didn't stop at being reconciled. They didn't stop at the transactional case. They kept going until it became kind of cultish. And I'm very proud that most of National Review has resisted that. And if you actually listen to, say, the editor's podcast that they do, they're sharply critical. But people like me and David French were increasingly being used as proof that the magazine was just never Trump and all of these kinds of things. And I think one of the problems that Rich has is that that job since William F. Buckley had it has always been in part to keep peace amongst the tribes.
Right.
I'm sure there's a similarity to that with reason, right? People talk about how libertarians all take the same
libertarians all believe exactly the same thing with exactly the same attitude and preference and provisioning.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's totally different.
And so one of the problems that Rich runs into is that I think on the editorial side of the magazine, he's more Trump sympathetic than almost anybody. But
very much so.
But in the larger, but in the world of the donors and that kind of thing, he's more critical than all those people are. And
right.
So he's just sort of caught in the switches, and I have nothing but sympathy for him. But, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to do this thing with Steve was that a lot of my heroes are institution builders. Mm-hmm. And I've done a lot of stuff on the right, but I've never done that.
And you did create, or you were the person who built out National Review Online.
Yeah, I was the founding editor of National Review Online, and I'm proud of that.
God, and that is what's amazing. You really came to prominence or to public view during the Bill Clinton impeachment hearings, and here we are 20 years later.
Yeah, and I'm talking about impeachment stuff again, and I'm writing a newsletter about impeachment stuff. Yeah. It's very strange. Yeah. And so I...
It's a time is a flat circle, as we learned in the first season, and really the only good season of True Detective.
But. Yeah, although I'm more sympathetic to the second season.
I liked it a lot because it was against the California high-speed rail project.
Yeah,
had Vince Vaughn, and I saw it as a...
Chinatown, but high-speed rail is kind of cool.
Right. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But also, I think that one of the things I've been trying to do for a while now is... model the behavior that I think is kind of missing on the right without being a douchebag about it, which is it's a tough needle to thread
what
sometimes.
What if you are a douchebag?
That's a problem. Yeah, you know, then I should just be true to myself, right?
That's right.
But thankfully, I don't believe in Rousseauian romanticism, and I don't believe in that stuff. So, and I did a lot of Smash Mouth stuff in my time, and there's a lot of it I'll still defend, but so much of that stuff has swamped the right, the Own the Libs stuff, the Tears Are Delicious stuff. So much of what my friend David French calls, now colleague, calls nut picking, where we take the worst examples of the other side and we hold them up like a Medusa's head and say, see, this is what all liberals are like, right? You combine that with the problems of sort of internet journalism or journalism generally these days, but particularly on the right, where people are just trying to monetize dopamine hits, where it's one kind of like, you know, see this person destroyed or, you know, you must be outraged and that kind of stuff. I think it's all crap. Or a lot of it is crap. And
can I ask, like, name names? Is that like, is Charlie Kirk part of the problem of Turning Point USA?
I think Charlie. Well, I'm in this very difficult crisis of conscience because the Groypers and the alt right neo-Nazi kids now hate him. And
oh, so now you kind of feel sympathy for him.
Well, if I have to pick.
You want to bring him back into the barracks at Stalag 13?
I'll take a Trumpist grifter over a neo-Nazi any day.
Okay, yeah.
And, yeah.
But so that's not even, that's as easy a moral choice as is constantly presented by Martin Scorsese movies. Like, just don't join the mob.
Right,
you
right,
know,
right.
Like, it's not complicated, really.
But, right.
Okay, so.
I think Turning Point USA is a problem.
Yeah.
I think it teaches, you know, it teaches these college Republican kids that simply because being rude is politically incorrect, it's therefore okay to be rude.
What about somebody like Ben Shapiro, then, who's also very much a never-Trumper, but who's also kind of made peace with, you know, Trump is better than Hillary, which, you know, is a completely legitimate argument.
Sure it is.
You know, absolutely. I mean, I would find myself in that camp. I'm not happy about either of them, but... You know, Trump is not the end of the world.
Right.
But what about Ben Shapiro?
Yeah, so Ben, I think Ben has done a better job than Charlie Kirk has. I could do without the liberal tears coffee mugs some of that kind of stuff. But Ben, my understanding of his position is that he's a sometimes Trumper.
Right.
What he means by that is there's good Trump and there's bad Trump. And he is not afraid to call out bad Trump when Trump is bad. I might disagree with his analysis on things, but he doesn't do the sort of Seb Gorka, you know, kind of thing.
Doctor.
Yeah.
This is, you know, I used to have an axiom that anybody who insisted on being called ambassador was a douchebag. And an analog to that is when you have doctor in your Twitter feed and things like that. And
particularly if you're not a medical doctor.
Yeah. Well, that as a PhD, I'm more than willing to say, fuck medical doctors.
Uh-huh.
Like, why should they be called doctor?
Yeah.
You know, they're just regular people. But Dr. Seb Gorka and Dr. Jill Biden.
Yeah.
You know,
no, I agree.
It's like either side of the aisle. They are just idiots when they when they foreground them.
I agree with that entirely.
But so Seb Gorka is I mean, his name even sounds like a bad monster movie, the Gorka.
It sounds like something that as you huddle over your partner in the Budapest PD, as he bleeds out, you scream to the heavens, shaking your fist, Gorka!
So Shapiro is better than Charlie Kirk. Both are better than Seb Gorka.
Yeah, well, look, so here, one of the fundamental problems that you get on the right these days is that, as you said before, the choice between the transactional choice of Trump is better than Hillary, that's a reasonable thing. That's a reasonable position to take. I said in my book that if the election came down to me, I probably would have voted for Trump, certainly over Hillary. I've challenged people to offer
Who did you vote for?
Oh, I wrote in somebody. I live in D.C. I don't give a rat's ass about my vote. My point is, the problem is that, you know, I hear this all the time from people. You should support Trump. And they make it sound like I should basically lie, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't understand what that means. If I am supposed to show my loyalty or support for Trump, does it mean I should pretend I don't understand how tariffs work,
mm-hmm.
right? Should I all of a sudden be okay with his praising of Putin over the intelligence agencies in Helsinki? I mean, you come up with all these crazy things that he does. You know, the tweeting like an escape monkey from a cocaine study stuff.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to say, oh, that's great. You know, what am I supposed to actually say? And this gets to my larger theory about what's happened to our politics, which is that as the parties have grown incredibly weak, partisanship has increased.
Okay, wait. How have the parties grown weak? Explain that.
Sure. We are the first advanced democratic nation in the world whose parties have given up the power to pick their own candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning
through like primary systems. There
have been primaries since for 100 years, but they didn't matter. If you go back and you look at the 1968 Democratic primary, the guy who came in sixth in terms of primary votes won.
And the Iowa caucuses only started mattering in 76, I think.
That's right.
Jimmy Carter.
With Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
And so
parties institutionally are weaker in terms of dictating.
They have very little control over what candidates say or do. And I mean, there's certain part like the Senate, senatorial campaign committee, whatever, has some power, right? Because Mitch McConnell is a boss and all that kind of stuff. And then you had campaign finance reform, where I think McConnell was absolutely right in, like, 98, where he said, we're not getting money out of politics, we're getting the parties out of politics.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the Watergate reforms. There are a bunch of different reasons why they're basically just brand names that we slap on one side or the other. And so people and institutions have internalized partisanship to the extent that they're performing party functions without realizing that they're party people. And a lot of pundits have gone that way, that at the end of the day, if the choice is between upholding an ideological or intellectually coherent philosophy and supporting the GOP candidate, they're going to support the GOP
candidate. So this explains the widely observed phenomenon that, you know, you identify as a Republican or Democrat, and you don't really care what they stand for. You stick with that party regardless.
Right.
And then occasionally there'll be a point where a party goes so far afield of what you can stomach, you flip or you become nonpolitical.
Right. And so this gets to my transactional point, which is that Donald Trump appointed, for the most part, really good judges, not because he gives a rat's ass about the Constitution.
Right.
I mean, he promised to protect Article 12 of the Constitution.
Right?
It's because it was made clear to him that people didn't trust him on judges.
Right.
So he outsourced it to the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, and I'm glad he did. Right? It was made clear to him that the Republican Party won't nominate or vote for somebody who's pro-choice.
Mm-hmm.
So he became pro-life. He never was, right? And same thing on guns. He was pro-gun control. He was soft on immigration. But there are certain hardline positions that it was explained to him, you can't win without doing these things, so he changed his position. That's actually how the conservative movement was supposed to work, is you put pressure on politicians so it's in their natural self-interest to take your positions. The problem is that now that he's in power, this sort of lizard brain thing has taken over, where we have to sort of think that all of his positions are the product of his genius. And
this very stable.
Extremely stable genius. And so the problem becomes you are not allowed in certain corners of the right these days to make the transactional argument in public.
Mm-hmm.
In private, almost all of them do.
Right.
Because I've run into like exactly zero Republican senators and maybe one or, with the exception of one or two Matt Gaetz kind of buffoons, zero Republican House members who actually believe any of the cult of Trump stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But you put a camera on them. And they have to say, you know.
And so, well, they will say, look, you know, tariffs are stupid or you know, they're in favor of free trade, but they're going to back Trump to the hilt on that.
Yeah, all that stuff. Yeah. I mean, they'll say, or they'll come up with these Jesuitical explanations about how he's, you know, I may disagree with him a little bit on this or that, but he's the first president to challenge China. And there's some merit to that. But for the most part, It's the sort of Sean Hannity, Seb Gorka stuff that you have to say in public. And if you say critical things or if you say that the impeachment proceedings, even if they're politically misguided or even unfair, which I'm open to those arguments, but they're not a hoax. They're not a coup. If you say these kinds of things.
I want to live through a coup.
But real coups do not involve hearings.
Right.
You know? And this is not what Soviet show trials look like.
Can I ask, though, what is the nub of your contempt for Trump because politically, you know, he's not perfectly in a kind of National Review sense. But I remember writing when the Against Trump story came out. You know, it's what's odd is that Trump in many ways has stolen a lot of National Review's issues. Like he's anti-abortion. He's anti-immigrant. He is, you know, big on defense spending and things like that. What's the nub of like why you're like, I can't deal with him?
People at National Review would say they weren't anti-immigrant, right?
That's sort of a libertarian formulation. Well, let me put it this way. You know, through the 90s and most of the 2000s, there seemed to be a consensus coming out of National Review that there should be fewer, certainly illegal immigration was always a problem, and there should be fewer legal immigration.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. That's totally fair. My own position on immigration policy was that we should have one.
Right.
And whatever it is, enforce it. Okay.
Right.
But anyway.
But is it Trump's style? Is it his erraticism?
I'll be perfectly honest. I don't like his style.
Yeah.
Right? I think he's objectively a person of bad character.
Yeah.
And I think that, I think there is no definition of good character that he can clear.
Right.
Right. Forget the infidelities. Forget all that stuff. Like he's a dishonest businessman. He's a dishonest politician. There's literally you cannot come up with a definition of good character that he can clear. But I've watched a lot of quote unquote serious intellectuals on the right try. And
right.
I think they've all embarrassed themselves to one extent or another. And so
can you give me a name? Who's the one who's embarrassed the most? Is it Henry Olson?
He hasn't gotten into the character stuff. I think some of the stuff that Roger Kimball has written about Trump's character is, I mean, he's very civil about it, and we're trying to remain friendly towards each other.
And he knows, like, kind of cult of personality. So he, I mean, as a student of the, you know, of the Soviets and the fascists and whatnot, he writes a very good pumping up of Trump.
Oh, absolutely.
Not simply as you know, phenomenal politician, but as a great man.
Yeah. Well, also the Clare monsters, many of whom individually I really respect.
The Clare monsters. Are they going to be in the reboot of Space Jam? that would be great. Yeah.
No, what was the Hanna-Barbera space alien cartoon with the...
Space Ghost?
It had the elephants that shot... the rhinos that shot exploding pieces of something out of their
this,
horns.
This, I really hope, doesn't exist, but in a part of me hopes that it does.
No, I know.
I don't
exists.
Know. Are you sure?
Oh, yeah.
I spent a lot of time...
I might even have a tattoo of them somewhere I can't show you.
I spent a lot of time trying to convince people I work with that the Funky Phantom was a thing. And
yeah,
I don't know if you remember that, but it was a ghost of a Revolutionary War hero who helped a gang of misbegotten kids in a dune buggy solve mysteries.
There were a lot of dune buggy cartoons.
Yeah, yeah.
There was also... I tried to, like, show my daughter what Johnny Quest was like. And they shot live ammo and killed people.
Oh, yeah. No, and it was always like it always came down to a ex-Nazi in a World War I biplane, which was confusing with pet Komodo dragons and a monarch.
Yeah, I'll send it to you later. But my favorite clip from Johnny Quest is I don't remember what the setup was, but they're fighting the gargoyle,
right?
And it turns out when they pull the mask off him, he's like, Hans Gelding, foremost Norwegian acrobat.
Well, of course. And yet we didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
You know? Have you watched The Venture Brothers?
No.
Oh, you should. The Venture Brothers was a Cartoon Network Adult Swim show that has like eight seasons, and it is a parody of Johnny Quest.
Is it really?
It is so incredible, and the people who created it are just brilliant.
Yeah, I should take a look. The post-colonialists, if they ever discover are going to have a field day. I don't remember how we got onto this, but...
You know, we're trying to flee from talking about politics.
Yeah.
But,
okay, so my brief against Trump, first of all, you know, Lord Acton had this famous line, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts, absolutely. The actual context of where that phrase comes from, he believed that.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to say he didn't, but the context where that phrase originally appears... He was admonishing a guy named Crichton, who was a historian who was writing a book about the popes. And Crichton was trying to make this case that you should cut the bad popes some slack because they had big jobs to do or something like that. Sort of the same case that Useful Idiots made about Stalin and Mao and all these people, right? And part of Acton's point was that he wasn't talking about absolute power corrupting the people who have the power. It's about the way it corrupted intellectuals and courtesans and those kinds of people around the powerful. And so part of my problem with Trump is that rather than saying, yeah, he falls short of our moral yardstick,
right,
but he's getting these important things done. We are instead taking a buzzsaw to the yardstick and refitting it to him, right? We're making the mold of what a person of good character is fit Trump, which I think is disastrous, both politically and for the culture. I also think my other problems with him is that, like, I could respect him if he were Pat Buchanan. You know, Pat Buchanan, smart guy. If he were president of the United States and wanted to get us out of forever wars and all the stuff that you probably agree with on foreign policy things, he'd actually have a plan to do it. He wouldn't have a glandular outburst in a phone call with a foreign dictator and completely upend in a moment's notice our national security strategy in the Middle East. He'd actually put measures into place. He talked to our allies. He's winging the entire presidency, and people are convincing themselves that he's playing four-dimensional, 32-dimensional chess. And I just think it's all bullshit. And so part of my problem is it's less that I can't stand Trump or anything like that. People think I'm an irrational Trump hater. I think he's kind of a buffoon, and he's kind of boring at times and entertaining at other times. But he's a populist demagogue who, because he actually believes a lot of the worst stuff about Republicans, he is actually pandering to those sentiments, and he's encouraging more of it.
So what are the worst elements, then, of Republicanism or of conservatives?
Yeah, so, I would like to... I'm not going to get angels on the head of a pin about distinctions between conservatism and right wing and all that kind of stuff. But, when I wrote my first book, Liberal Fascism, part of the point I made was that conservatism, American conservatism, is in the tradition of classical liberalism. It's more than just classical liberalism, but a conservatism that doesn't conserve classical liberalism isn't worth conserving, right? And his stuff is anti-immigrant, right? And it's just flat out anti-immigrant, and people...
And he's anti, in that sense, he's also kind of anti, I don't want to say rule of law because that's kind of vague, but like the whole idea of setting up structures that limit what anybody can in power can do at any moment in time. Because he doesn't believe in the Constitution. He doesn't believe in process. It's like if he feels it, it must be right, and so it shall be done.
That's right. His idea of the presidency is much more monarchical.
Right.
And he thinks that his will is the determinant of what can be done. And so part of my critique of Trump has to do with the fact that you're seeing sort of the Michael Anton types, you want more names, right, who make allowances for this stuff because he's our son of a bitch,
right?
I mean, Michael Anton, before he deleted all of it and he was hiding behind that pseudonym, we had this back and forth where he was saying how the Martin Luther King vision of judging people by the content of their character, not the color of their skin, and the sort of classical liberal colorblind view was dead. And so therefore we need our own identity politics to fight their identity politics. I hate identity politics. And a conservatism, if conservatives give up the effort to defend the Constitution, even when the Constitution's inconvenient for their narrow or short-term political ends, if they give up on this idea that the president isn't a monarch, it's not like the Democrats can be trusted to all of a sudden leap to the defense of the founding or anything like that.
Right.
And so it's kind of a suicidal choice if we say we have to be, this, I think I'm partly to blame for the Alinsky envy that took over the right, because I was one of the first guys to talk about Alinsky and liberal fascism. And in my defense, I held up Alinsky as a really bad guy. I didn't hold him up as an example for what we should do, too.
So what's going on among conservatives, and you're as good a person to ask, or you're a better person to ask than any, given that you've written a history, an intellectual history of a lot of elements in America, but especially of conservative thought and whatnot. Why are conservatives so susceptible to, like to burn it all down?
Yeah.
Because they are, if I'm remembering correctly, I mean, part of what National Review like explicitly was trying to do was conserve. The whole idea was like we're putting up firewalls around certain elements, traditions in American thought and American culture, world culture. So why are so many conservatives now dying to burn it all down?
Yeah. So one, because they're being told to. Right. And they're getting a narrative that is unmediated and sort of pure from Fox News and other sources that doesn't really give them a clear picture of the other side of some of these arguments. But also in their defense, they've been peed on from a great height by cultural elites for a very, very long time. When you hear people say over and over again how wonderful it will be when we're no longer a majority white country, and that, that the era of white supremacy, whatever that's supposed to be, is nearing an end. And, you know, all the whiteness studies mm-hmm. nonsense and all the rest, it is natural for human beings to get defensive about that if they're talking about them. And if you're constantly be called a racist, Sherry Berman wrote a great piece about this a while back, about how the more you call people racist, the more likely right. they are to become racist.
I mean,
racist.
So part of it is that you would say the left is conjuring the beast that it's so afraid of.
I think it's the right is getting has an allergic reaction mm-hmm. to a lot of the things that the left is doing. And I understand it because I hate a lot of the stuff that the left is doing, too. I'm just very much against of if you can't beat them, join them thinking. And you say, take the Tea Parties, for example. I've been a critic of populism mm-hmm. forever, long before Trump came on the scene. And I'm generally opposed to political enthusiasm, generally, right?
Sure.
And I don't like big crowds. I don't like the logic of big crowds. I don't like that kind of passion. That's one of the reasons why I like the system that the founders set up, which takes the passion from the people, but then channels it in productive mm-hmm. measure. The Tea Parties were the first example of a populist movement I could get behind. They were mm-hmm. talking about living within the means of the mm-hmm. our spending. They were talking about returning to basics on the Constitution. I would go to Tea Party things. They were handing out copies of the Fatal Conceit and the Federalist Papers. It was awesome. They cleaned up after themselves. Yeah. You know, they're still called racists for it. Right. And I think for an enormous number of people, there was a kind of psychic break that happened where they basically said, you know, we tried to do this. We tried to make the right arguments the right way, and we were demonized anyway for it. And now the sort of Michael Anton sort of thinking of the Flight 93 election stuff comes around. And I think one of my criticisms of Trump is that he is behaving, you know, it's not just monarchical. It's he's behaving as if he's a war president. Right. And you know this history as well as I do. More equivalent war stuff is a real problem in American history on the left and the right. And when the thing, though, is the enemy that we're fighting isn't some foreign enemy. It's the other, it's the political opposition. And the second you get into a Flight 93 argument is just simply another way of saying moral equivalent to war.
Yeah,
right?
And to say that controlling image of an essay that was influential among many people on the right is that we are on Flight 93, which was the last of the planes on 9/11,
right?
And we've got to fight back.
We have
because our civilization is crashing.
Sean Hannity began his radio show for months saying we're only X number of days before potentially the end of America.
Yeah.
Because if Hillary won, it would be the end mm-hmm. of America. I am of the view that if we're one election away from America being over, America is already over, because that's not how it works. But that mindset of, you know, when you're in, you know, a vicious trench warfare battle, the concepts of fair no longer apply. And that logic becomes self-justifying, and Trump has been unleashing it constantly mm-hmm. amongst his followers. And so you just see these people jettisoning what were once sort of staple conservative points of view and to sort of reverse engineer and rationalize anything they can in defense of Trump. And I just think it's grotesque.
So there's a long history of apocalypticism in American politics, and certainly in the post-war era. And National Review participated in it. Reason has participated in it in its own way. You know, groups like The Nation or Mother Jones, where, you know, if this doesn't stop, we're done. We're over. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there are communists everywhere. There are the gay agenda is taking over.
Jihadists.
Jihadists. Mm-hmm. Environmental concerns, like if we ever change any EPA regulation to make it looser, you know, we're all dead.
My favorite was net neutrality.
They
literally said it would be the end of civilization.
Yeah, and, you know, maybe they were right. I mean, why are we talking, you know, if they're not right? But in the late 50s, and I mean, you know, the modern right is in large part a function of National Review and of Bill Buckley and his ragtag band of, you know, Yale graduates and former communists and Yale grads or CIA people and stuff. They policed the right. They famously kicked out the John Birch Society. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you and David French mm-hmm. are on the, you are the John Birch Society now? You're being kicked out of the conservative movement.
I understand the question. There are days when I have that mm-hmm. feeling. You know, it's very weird. One of the strangest sensations of my professional life was post 2016, when everybody sort of assumed that, okay, we understand you didn't like him in the primaries, mm-hmm. but now because you're a de facto party guy, you mm-hmm. have to rally to this guy. And when I didn't, it was very strange to have people mad at me for not living down to their expectations. Mm. And so there's a lot of that. But I will say, when you meet normal rank and file conservatives, Republicans in the real world outside of the Beltway, they're much more on the one hand, on the other hand, even mm-hmm. about Trump than you would get the sense from watching either MSNBC or Fox.
Right.
And that's reassuring. The place where I think the analogy kind of breaks down is that the Birch Society was crazy,
mm-hmm.
right? And so if you're talking about the conspiracy theory kind of people, calling us the Birch Society is the wrong way.
I'm having some fun with that.
I'm not the deep state guy. I'm not the DNC server in Ukraine guy. Yeah. That's the president. It's more like the Birch Society
has taken over.
Taken the White House.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where does that leave you in terms of the Dispatch? Mm-hmm. I mean, let's talk about this again. Like, what are the stories? What are the takes? What's the tone of the Dispatch?
Yeah. So one of the things we're trying to do is slow things down a little. We're not going to do, did you see this one tweet? You know, that kind of stuff. We also want to be the kind of place where if we take the conservative side on something, we're not doing it out of team loyalty. We're mm-hmm. doing it because it's the right position. We are obviously going to be ideologically sympathetic to the GOP on a lot of things, mm-hmm. but we're going to be journalistically skeptical about a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And the same thing goes for like the Christian right. David French is doing a Sunday newsletter for us about religion.
And to just so everybody understands, David French, late of National Review, is a very committed evangelical Christian.
Very committed, yeah. Yes. But he's also willing to call out the people who say, Trump is like King David,
right.
And that, the sort of...
And I realize I may be more skeptical of both Old and New Testament figures uh-huh. than many people in your orbit, but like, I don't know that I want to be like King David.
It's
like King David is kind of like a bad hombre in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I also certainly don't want to live in a country under King David. But the analogy I often use, and you're old enough to remember this, is it's a little bit like the old New Republic, right? You knew those guys were liberal,
right?
But at the same time, they weren't afraid to call BS on their own side.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean I agreed with everything they did or anything like that, but this is part of my point about how the parties have become so weak. A lot of institutions basically perform party functions where they do, instead of the RNC doing opposition research, the Free Beacon does it.
Right.
I like a lot of the stuff the Free Beacon does, and a lot of those guys are friends of mine. And a lot of that stuff should be done. Think tanks, I'm an AEI guy.
Yeah.
Think tanks do a lot of the policy formulation. The problem is, like, when you start expanding outwards, you see a lot of places like talk radio, which are basically just an arm of the Trump-run RNC mm-hmm. in a lot of respects. And do I don't want to do water carrying.
Do you think it'll go away when Trump goes away, whether that's 2020 or 2024?
It will get better, mm-hmm. I think, because, look, first of all, Trump is sui generis, right? I mean, I love the idea, just the image of Mike Pence lying in bed thinking of how he's going to inherit the kingdom.
Mm.
The idea that Mike Pence could fill a stadium the way Trump does is insane, right? I mean, so much of what Trump does, and there's a brilliance to it, to be mm-hmm. sure, but it's pro wrestling kayfabe, right? Mm. It's shtick. And part of the reason why he frustrates me is I don't think he always understands his shtick, mm-hmm. but it's shtick. But Mike Pence can't do that. There's basically no one in the GOP who can arouse that kind of passion out of people. And if Trump loses in 2020 and it's a President Biden or a President Warren or whatever, there's going to be a lot of, mending of fences.
Right.
But I don't think we're ever going to get back to where we were, in part because, and we can talk about this in the Goldberg portion of this, we're coming up
to the end of my hour with you, and we're going to flip the tables, and we'll continue this on Jonas.
But the effort from like my friend Sora Mamari and Yoram Hazony and Senator Hawley and these guys, mm-hmm. right? What they are trying to do, even Marco Rubio lately, right? They are trying to create some, I keep they keep changing what label I'm allowed to apply to it. A post-liberal, they're calling it a lot. Some sort of nationalistic understanding of economics and the role of the federal government that is distinct from what they are calling the dead consensus of liberalism. I don't think all that toothpaste can be put back in the tube.
And let's talk about them a little bit in the time we have left, because that, I mean, it's, I know as a libertarian why I dislike the Sohrab Ahmari, who, you know, started a lot of this recent cycle of vituperation among conservatives by writing against David Frenchism.
Right.
And he said basically that French's problem was that he was essentially libertarian and that he thought that the state or that public and public or political institutions should be kind of neutral referees and that the state shouldn't tell you how to live, that there isn't one conception of the good that the state, like the rest of society and church in particular, exists to create. And for Ahmari, that's like, no, that he rejects that, that the state should be like that. Where is that coming from? And do you think that is actually gaining power among conservatives? Or is this, you know, just a weird emanation, you know, coming out of, you know, late Trumpism?
I think it's too soon to tell.
Yeah.
But I, again, I mean, look, I mean, it's, I can give you an optimistic or a pessimistic version of it. On the one hand, Sohrab was perfectly willing to write these really wonderful essays in defense of liberalism and the global threat of illiberalism just a couple of years ago.
Right.
And now he's saying, okay, we're done with liberalism. So he could switch back, you know?
Yeah.
And at the same time, I think that the there's so many people, there's so many people and institutions who've bought in to the basic structure of these arguments. Which doesn't mean all of their ideas are all bad, right? I mean, Yuval Levin is a friend of mine. He's a colleague of mine at AI. He's more sympathetic to some of this stuff than I am. But Yuval's, at the end of the day, is sort of a Hayekian, Burkean guy, and he's not for, like, huge nanny statism and all of that
Although
kind of stuff.
Although he's for a kind of conservative nudge, right, that the state, you know, it should always be working towards his conception of the good through tax policy or new welfare. I mean, whether it's paid
family
leave
I'll let Yuval defend himself, but... there's probably more of that in Yuval than you would like.
Yeah.
But again, my conception of conservatism isn't purely just classical liberalism, but one should be very, very, very careful about, first of all, one size fits all anything, which he believes in. He's very much a localism guy. And, you know, this is something I talk about on my podcast all the time is that, you know, you and I know these, we've lived these arguments about, you know, Hayek and is skepticism about planning,
right?
And every conservative I've known has always paid lip service to this stuff, even if they don't know they're Hayek, they know the general gist of it. And it turns out that a whole bunch of people could flip a switch and say, well, it's not so much planning we're against, it's their planning. But our planning, that'll work out great. And I don't see how they can make that argument.
Do you think, you know, one of the funny things from a libertarian perspective is that over the past couple of months, both liberals for different reasons and conservatives are saying, you know, this is, you know, it's all the libertarians' fault. Because we've been living in this incredible world where the government doesn't tip the scale. The government is starving people literally and figuratively and all that. And, you know, I'm kind of like, wow, I'm not in that timeline. I'm in I'm in the worst of Man in the High Castle. I'm in the other, you know, occupied America states. But, you know, does this move you more towards a libertarian position? We've talked about this for, we've been sparring for, you know, 20 years or so. Does this push you more in a libertarian tradition or to a libertarian space where, you know, and it's not that we don't have our value judgments and we want things, but it's like, yeah, we really should be stripping down what is being done by the government or by the state because, man, if the wrong people get in charge, things can go bad really quickly.
Yeah, no, so it's my journey towards more libertarianism, to a more libertarian position, began when I wrote my first book, Liberal Fascism, in part because you just saw what the progressives wanted to do with government. And I don't want the government to have that power, even if I agree with it, right? And so the short answer is yes. The the slightly longer answer is I've become much more sympathetic. I mean, you use this phrase every now and then on the Reason podcast, or one of the Reason podcasts, you know, a utopia of utopias.
Right.
And we're going to talk about this on our segment. A utopia of utopias which I take to mean a bunch of different communities setting their own rules about how they want to live, I'm much more sympathetic and desirous of living in a country where we give people a lot of power to do that. You still have the right to, have to have the right to exit. But if you want to live in a community that bans alcohol and you can't get it overturned democratically by making an argument for allowing it in your little town, so be it. Move. Right. And that stuff.
Or if your library is hosting, you know, transvestite reading hours and stuff.
Yeah. And I don't, I'm not a huge fan of transgender story hour.
Right.
And I wouldn't send my kids to it. And I would yell at my local librarian or my school's librarian for doing it. But I think this is one of the problems you get with social media is that we are wired to be really angry when our neighbors live wrong, live the wrong way.
Right.
And the nationalizing effect of social media makes us think that what people are doing 3,000 miles away is happening next door.
Right.
And that's one of the things that makes our politics so much uglier.
Do you find, and maybe this will be a final note for this part of this incredible crossover, you likened it, as we were discussing it on email, to the episode where, I'm sorry, it was Laverne.
Laverne went on a date with Mork.
Well, that must have ended well. Do you, what do you think about the idea, and this is something that libertarians have only begun struggling with or engaging, is the idea that when you say social media that, you know, in the 21st century, governance is more and more out of the hands of the state. Mm-hmm. And it's more in the hands of kind of like giant corporations that, you know, show up in movies like Alien or, you know, a Neal Stephenson novel. And, you know, that if we're using the model that we inherited from the Enlightenment and the 19th century and even the 20th century, we're not really talking about how power operates in the contemporary world. And this, and I guess one of the reasons to bring this up, people like Ted Cruz, people like Marco Rubio, they have analogs on the left, are saying, you know what, we really should be regulating Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, as utilities.
I'm more sympathetic to the possibility there's an argument. I'd be sympathetic there too.
Yeah.
You know, I just haven't heard it. I thought your interview with Glenn Reynolds was really interesting about this stuff,
And Glenn Reynolds, fascinating, you know, one of the blog fathers,
right?
Of the way that we talk about stuff, very libertarian, has become, you know, he wants to see social media companies broken up.
Yeah.
He's a law professor as well, so he kind of knows what he's talking about.
And so I'm not there yet. I still worry about, you know, the idea that if you're going to say the state is going to police the content on these things, you need to really show me your homework how that's going to work, because the ability to sanction corporations is greater than the ability to sanction the government when the bureaucrats get control of stuff.
Right.
And so I'm sympathetic to that. But when you hear the sort of common version on the sort of Twitter version of this argument, which is, you know, the government needs to, you know, so-and-so has been deplatformed, the government needs to get involved. And it's like, I don't, you know, the government, the idea that a bunch, particularly the people who are getting deplatformed, are not, for the most part, a bunch of great people.
Right.
That doesn't mean we should be in favor of deplatforming necessarily, or we should have reservations about it. But the idea of giving that power to the state, it's still a real big problem.
So it's a lot easier to leave Twitter than to leave the United States.
That's right. And one of the things I do this regular, it's becoming a tradition of this half-baked ideas episode where you come up with ideas that are not quite ready to write a policy paper on. You know, one of the things I love about the Dune books is that they solved some of these problems with guilds, right? So we need more institutions. I'm an institution guy, right? And so if you have institutions that are, whose brand is in being incorruptible, some of them will still be corrupted, but they have a brand investment in being incorruptible. If you can set up institutions that can work as respect, you know, whether it's the Mentats or whoever, right? That may be a sort of Hayekian response to this, is that we need to create institutions get created to solve problems. We have problems now. Maybe we should start creating some institutions to help solve them.
I have to admit that I have never gotten over the David Lynch Dune movie.
I understand that.
So,
I still cut myself over that as well.
And you, again, to make a pitch for the Venture Brothers, the main organization of supervillains is called the Guild of Calamitous Intent. And essentially, they're a union for supervillains, and they have a very rule-bound system of grievances and how you figure out who you're going to arch and things like that.
Yeah, well, The Mandalorian, it's a guild.
I guess so,
right?
Yeah. I'm done with Star Wars, I think.
The Mandalorian is the most redeeming thing to come out of that genre or that franchise in years.
I was a big fan, and I'll admit it, to the Phantom Menace. And I loved when Jar Jar Binks became a senator. Like, I would watch hours of, like, Star Wars C-SPAN. I loved the procedural stuff in that, but the rest of the whole universe is just not working for me anymore.
All right, we'll pick up this on the
Remnant. Yes, we are going to stop here.
This has been a very special episode of The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Remember to go to jonahgoldberg.com or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to the second half of this conversation, in which the author of Liberal Fascism and Suicide of the West grills me about libertarianism in the age of Donald Trump. Subscribe to The Remnant. And, of course, don't forget to make a tax-deductible donation to Reason's annual Webathon and to subscribe to this podcast, as well as the Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum debates. Go to reason.com to do all that. Thanks for listening.